This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. Alrighty, we've had a slightly longer break than usual. However, back to the business of the night. Our second reader is Miss Jessica Rydell, and I'll leave her to introduce what she's going to read.
Okay, can you hear me all right? I'll try using the mic, but I won't throw it away. Right, this is an extract from my first novel, which originally came out in 2001, and it's coming out again first thing next year with Crystal Ink. Hey. And it's called Children of the Shaman, but it's not a children's book. It's quite hard to summarise, but I suppose what I would say is it's set in a very roughly 19th century alternate version of France with lots of Russians and things in it. And it's sort of very like this world, but not quite, and has magic. And this is an extract from chapter one. It starts with the narrator, or the main narrator, who's a 13-year-old girl called Anat. The steam coach, with its terrible springing, seemed to jolt over every bump and rut, rattling Anat's teeth. She was wedged between her aunt and the side of the carriage, but the window was so smeared with mud she could not see out. It was getting dark, and it would soon be time to kindle the oil lamp that swung from the roof. They must be about an hour from Mussel Yar. Except for the old woman sitting opposite, whose droning voice and complaints had been a refrain for much of the journey, the three of them were the only passengers. Her brother Malchik was leaning in the corner, on the opposite side from Aunt Juste, sleeping or pretending to sleep. Anat wriggled uncomfortably in the leather seat, drawing a glance from her aunt. "It'll be the end of our civilization, you mark me," said the old woman. She was not from their village, and the coach had picked her up about halfway to Mussel Yar. "I wouldn't know. We are wanderers," said Juste, sounding out of patience. Anat focused on the old woman, waiting for her reaction. "Are you so? Don't meet many of your kind out here. Most of them prefer to stay in the city." "Your kind." Anat put a fringe of her hair into her mouth. "They always said that, the Doxoi." She did not need to ask if the old woman were one. All the country people believed. All the villages had their church with its blue ground priest. Where she came from, her family had been the only wanderers. It was different in the city. Her people. Her kind. "My father has a farm in Sankt Eglis. He's the village doctor there," said Juste. The old woman's mouth chewed on nothing as she thought this over. "I've heard of him. That would be the Dr. Vasilievich. His wife had twins, I heard, and that's not all I heard." "I'm one of the twins," said Juste with a fleeting smile, interrupting the old woman before she could divulge the rumour. Anat was disappointed. "So you are," said the old woman without embarrassment, "and these must be your children." "Not mine, my brother's. I'm taking them to meet him." Anat looked out of the blind window. She could see a faint reflection of her face, the delicate bones and pointed features, her eyes two brown shadows. "They say I look like him." She knew that Malchik remembered him, for he had been 5 years old when Tata, that was the wanderer word for father, walked out of the family house, leaving them and their mother forever. Malchik was cast in their mother's likeness, slender and fair, except for his hazel eyes with their flecks of green. He had the height of a tall man, but his limbs were fine and delicate. Anat had always been the one who liked to climb trees or the cliff, to swim and run, but alone. She wondered what was in Malchik's mind as he dozed in the corner of the carriage. Though she had known him all her 13 years, he was often an enigma to her. She was so different. If there was something in her mind, she said it. Perhaps that was another reason she had no friends of her own age. And is he a doctor too, their father? I've heard that many of your sort are doctors. Not a doctor, a healer. The old woman's eyes were glass beads in the twilight. You mean a sorcerer, she snapped. Eustace shook her head. No, I don't mean that, she said. The old woman's lips became a sour purse. She said no more, but took some knitting from the heavy bag beside her and took to muttering over pearls and planes. Eustace turned to Annette and gave her a secret, mischievous smile. Tutter was a shaman, as Annette was. He would teach her healing when they were together. Annette felt the faint crackle of power as she flexed her fingers. Sometimes it was good that people thought you were a sorcerer. They were afraid of you and they respected you. Other times it was bad. They threw stones after you in the street and talked under their breath of burning. Eustace clasped Annette's wrist with her warm, thin hand, as if she had read her mind. Perhaps she had. Eustace had that one power left, though she had lost the others. When Annette met Tutter, she would be able to talk to him silently and he would answer. They called it sprechen. She would not be cut off and alone, a wanderer and a shaman amongst people who did not understand or like either. The last hour seemed the longest. At first, Annette thought that she was seeing a reflection of the oil lamp in the window pane. Its image multiplied as it swung to and fro. Soon there were too many lights, some distant and far like stars, others so close that they threw a warm glow into the carriage. They had street lamps in Masolyar, kept burning by the householders to make the streets safer, Eustace had told her. And now the story was becoming reality, and Annette was moving into the dream. They would meet their father, and he would take them far away into the north, through the country of bandits and soul men. She clutched the hard wooden body of the doll to her chest. The doll had been her mother's and her mother's mother's. It was old and smooth, though Eustace had made a new dress for it out of green silk when Annette was a child. When it had been time to pack, Annette had taken the doll and her viel and a few clothes, white blouses, black skirts and black pinafores. The doxoi had made a law that wanderers must dress in two colours, black and brown, to remind them of their dirt and shame. White was allowed because it was no colour. Eustace and Malchik both wore brown, but Annette preferred the crow darkness of black, which made her face look pale and her eyes large. For some time now, the thin tyres of the steam coach had been rattling over cobblestones, making a tinny melody. There were people in the street outside, the people of Masolyar, but Annette could not see their faces. Eustace unpinned the watch from her bodice to peer at its dial in the dim light. 10 o'clock, she said in her dry voice. We're late, of course. Malchik twisted his head towards her, and the light flashed across his glasses. How much longer is it? He asked sleepily. Eustace leaned past him towards the window. I have no idea where we are, she commented. The central station is near the port. We could be on the moon for all I can see. Malchik gave a croaking laugh. His voice sounded as though it had recently broken for all his 18 years. The old woman looked up from her knitting, sniffed, and raised the needles closer to her face. Annette saw the lines of Eustace's amusement. Her aunt was almost an old woman, 36, and not married yet. Most girls in the village married when they were 16, straight from their dolls to the marriage bed. They called Eustace a spinster. When Annette had whispered this to her grandmother, Bubba had shaken her head. It was not customary for wanderers to marry so young. Annette slipped her right thumb into her mouth, hoping that Eustace would not notice. There was a rough callus below the knuckle. She had been sucking it so long. She was not sure that she wanted to meet Tata. What was it that Malchik had whispered to her last night after they had said their prayers? It had been unlike Malchik to tell her anything. If he wanted to confide in anyone, he chose Juste or their grandparents. You know he doesn't really want us. If he cared what happened to us, why did he never visit? It's not so far. Anat had never asked herself such questions. She had grown up accepting her father's absence as part of the landscape, like a distant shadow on the horizon. There had been Justi and Bubba and Zaidi and even Mama, though she had not shown much interest in Anat. That had been the picture of Anat's family, sheltering together on the cliffs like storm-blown petrels. The carriage jolted to a halt, almost throwing them into a heap on top of the old woman and her knitting. Juste sank back in her seat, adjusting the pins that kept her brown velvet hat in place on her hair. Almost before Anat had recovered her breath, the driver wrenched open the door next to Malchik, who leaned out to see where they were. He jumped out of the carriage, moving with the eagerness of a young boy and his usual clumsiness. Once outside, he turned back to the coach to see whether Juste would follow, but Anat was first, clutching her doll to her chest. The silver aura of the huge lights made her blink. They were in a vast shed, higher than the tallest barn, which seemed to stretch into infinite and promising darkness, marked with silver lamps. The shadows of the first trains that Anat had ever seen lurked in the distance, dwarfing, even from there, the steam coach with its long funnel. It was parked at its buffers next to the shallow platform where she had alighted. She turned on the spot, dazzled like a moth, focusing on the lamps until Juste brushed past her. Three men appeared. They moved towards Juste, and there was a moment of hesitation, of wordless pause, before the foremost clapped his hands together and bowed. Juste mimicked him. Anat stared at this puppet show. She was seeing a new Juste, one who was not just her aunt, but a woman whom strangers recognised and greeted. The first man was little, mostly bald, with bright eyes dark as wine and cheeks the colour of old leather. This was Anat's first dark man from Ind, far in the east, and she knew his name. It was Prakash Chival, Juste's teacher, whom she wrote to every week. They were embracing now, with the close lock of long-lost friends, ignoring the others who eyed each other cautiously. Anat stood apart from Malchik. Her stomach felt hollow and queasy sweet, full of birds' wings. One of the other men was her father, Yuda, Juste's twin. The two men were dressed much alike in city clothes, black jackets made from leather, open-necked shirts of fine cotton, not like the coarse stuff that Juste bought from the village weaver to make Anat's blouses, and dark trousers cut close to the leg, different from a countryman's trews. She guessed which was her father at once, for his companion was dark-skinned, tall, and his shirt was red, a colour forbidden to wanderers. He was gazing at Anat, half-smiling, but she had already fixed on her father, so short, scarcely taller than Juste. It was the image of his shaman's power that marked him out to her inner eye, a vivid coruscating blue that dimmed Anat's own uncertain flame. She hardly saw his face before Juste's warm hand took hers and brought her to Chival. Her father waited at a distance with his dark friend. "Welcome to Massalyar, Anat and Malchik. You are tired and rather nervous. So are we. We have been waiting for weeks to meet you." "How do you know what I'm thinking? You're not a shaman," said Anat. "I told you she was rude," said Juste. Chival smiled at Anat, and she had to smile back. He was small and leathery and full of a shy warmth that she might trust. "I study people just as I study books. Their faces, their movements tell a story. You were a shaman, I saw that at once." Anat looked for her father. She was not afraid, only that strange feeling, like fluttering below her chest, that made her breathless. "Speak," she willed him, sending a message into the silence. "There is one in Zion." It was not a voice, but clear as a black script on white paper, a reply which Juste had never been able to give her. Chival beckoned the two men. "Here is your father, Yuda, and Sharka, his friend." Both men wore their hair long like women. Sharka's was knotted into plaits, bound at the back with a thong. Yuda's was loose and smooth like black feathers. Anat leaned closer to Juste, wishing she was still a little child who could bury her face in her aunt's clean-scented skirts. She felt Juste's arm encircle her shoulders. "Hello, Yuda," Juste said, with gentle wariness. She extended her free hand to Sharka, who bent to kiss it with a flowing gesture. "You've brought the kinder, then," said Yuda, as if he had not yet noticed Anatol Malchik. His face was jet on ivory, like Zaidi, who had been just as dark and as pale, with a face like a tall clock, and who had looked down at Anat with sad, sweet eyes. Her father's eyes were not sad, sweet. His gaze on Juste was dangerous, mocking and fierce and inscrutable. Anat relished the wildness from the safety of her aunt's embrace. It promised adventure, not the dull severity she had feared from Malchik's stories. "I brought them up for you, Yuda. I wouldn't part with them now if I wasn't sick." "By God, it's been so long," he said, and hugged her, somehow enveloping Anat. She could smell the tobacco and leather of his jacket. Juste's body shook as she sobbed once. Anat looked up, disentangling herself at her aunt's half-seen face. It would be strange to feel so much for Malchik. She loved Juste, Bubi, and Zaidi. Her brother was just there, mostly ignoring her.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.